Chapter 10, The Birth of Mary Catherine Gallagher. For years, my dad had been giving me all sorts of career advice, saying things like, put on your high heels, doll yourself up, and you march right into the offices of those Hollywood agents and say, hey, hold the phone, I got talent. And don't forget, Molly, use your singing voice. So, when I got a meeting in New York City with Barbara Jarrett, a talent manager who represented a ton of child actors, I did sing. I walked in, hopped up on her desk, and launched into the song Chicago, the Judy Garland version in honor of my father. I was belting it out, and Barbara started clicking her fingers. Then she said, you got it, kid, and I was signed. Barbara Jarrett represented another actress my age who was getting a lot of calls because she had full-color headshots. They were a lot more expensive than the black and white ones, but headshots were your calling card, and I thought, ooh, I want to do full-color headshots. Everybody has black and white. Color's going to get attention. So this other actress sent me to the guy who did hers, this trendy fashion photographer. Headshot photography was big business. I gave him all my money from working at the health club to pay for it. Then, on the day of the shoot, I got my makeup and hair done. It comes with a headshot package fee. They get somebody to do your hair and makeup. I was feeling so pretty and excited, then I stood up, ready for my big photo shoot. The photographer studied me while his model girlfriend stood behind him. I thought, I'm going to take over this town. I felt like $1 million. Then he asked me, why are you so ugly? The model girlfriend, giggling, said, oh my God, cut it out. What a jerk. Why are you so ugly? But I was devastated. Barbara Jarrett got me some work on soap operas, but I also started to think, gosh, here I am at NYU, paying all this money. I really need to take advantage of college. There were kids who had everything paid for by their parents who were constantly on stage and being seen. I thought, I'm going to audition for one of the school productions. Another NYU drama student also worked at Park Avenue Squash and Fitness selling memberships. His name was Eugene Pack, and he is now an Emmy-nominated and Drama Desk Award-winning writer, producer, performer. He cast me as Mona May in the NYU staging of Come Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean, Jimmy Dean, the dramedy Robert Altman used as the basis for the movie that fascinated Anne and me when we were little girls. Eugene directed the production, too. Then, in my last year, I tried out for this on-campus comedy review show called The Follies, where students would make fun of all the teachers. We did the show in a black box theater at midnight, and there were great writers working on it. David Weinseck and Michael Sayers, Dan Jinks produced, Madeline Olneck was the writer-director. This was the first time I ever tried out for something comic, and I got cast. It was a very small cast, and Adam Sandler got cast as well. He was unknown to the public, but at NYU, he was already famous. He would do stand-up shows in the cafeteria at Weinstein, the dorm where he lived. He would just get up and do these big shows. And people loved him. He was quickly becoming very well-known on campus. Students were like, oh my God, Sandler, man. And he was the one student who was hustling at night, other than Gina. Working his act out at stand-up clubs, honing his material, he was probably working harder than anyone in that entire drama school. Most people were just studying acting, but Adam was so ambitious and focused and on stage all the time when he was really still a kid. You could see at a very young age that he was a standout. But Madeline thought he was shy, so she asked me, would you be able to take Adam out for coffee so you can maybe, you know, bring him out of his shell? I just said, Adam Sandler is not shy, and I do not think Adam Sandler needs my help. Trust me, it's going to be the reverse. I'm going to need Adam's help. But obviously, Madeline had good taste. During rehearsal one day, we did an improv exercise where she was a big movie director who was very hard to please, and we had to try to win her over to get a part. Don't think about it too much, she said. Just make up a character and walk through the door and introduce yourself and try to impress me. I just walked in, and without any time to plan, on total impulse, blurted out, hi, I'm Mary Catherine Gallagher. I was doing the character as a very nervous person, just an exaggerated version of myself and kind of how I felt. And when Madeline was not impressed, I'd have to come back and try to impress her more. I loved who I could pull from myself and create. By helping me find this character inside myself, Madeline was like the midwife for Mary Catherine Gallagher. It was a whole new world of writing a character and then working with this great team shaping the show. Not only did they put me in the Follies, but they ended up creating a second whole show around this early version of the Mary Catherine Gallagher character. This first version of the character wore red pants and a red shirt and turned out to be a murderess. The midnight performances got so raucous and the show was so popular that there were lines around the block to get in. The show and Mary Catherine Gallagher became an on-campus hit. Students would recognize me and say to each other, "Oh my God, it's that girl!" Before doing The Follies, I was a very serious dramatic actress. But then people started telling me, "You should be on Saturday Night Live." I thought, really? I'd never considered that before. I realized, God, comedy does come so naturally for me. It was a real revelation, people saying, "You should do comedy." It was fantastic. I loved it. It just felt so right. So this show was another major turning point in my life. For the whole summer after the Mary Catherine Gallagher debut, I kept getting congratulated. After a while, the praise began to have its effect. Maybe I should go to LA and try to get on TV and pursue this comedy thing, I thought. Huh, comedy. I had gone out to LA in the summer of 1987 before my last year of NYU. I wanted to see if I liked California, and I thought maybe I could get an agent out there. I lived at the USC dorms because they were dirt cheap, maybe like $15 a week. But USC was on the east side of LA, so far away from everything. I didn't know anybody, I didn't have a car, and I was very lonely. To survive, I got a job as a waitress at the Old Spaghetti Factory on Sunset Boulevard. I had to take the bus to work every day 7 miles away. The Old Spaghetti Factory was a giant, disgusting restaurant. They had a serious rodent problem and told me to keep it low-key if I saw anything scurrying around. One night, as I was carrying a massive tray of spaghetti to some customers, a big rat crawled across the floor in front of me, and I leaped up on the chair in the center of the packed dining room and started pointing and screaming, "Ew, gross, a rat, ah, gross, it's a rat, ew, 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 a rat, look, look, ah!" Oh my God, and I created such a scene. I pointed it out to everyone. People ran out of the restaurant. A little baby threw up. Then I slipped off the chair and spaghetti flew everywhere. One of the managers said, "Please, Molly, do not ever make a scene like that again." I mostly worked at night. Before the customers arrived, we had to practice our serving skills by waiting on the managers and they would quiz us on the menu. Then I carried huge trays of pasta classics and these oversized jugs of wine and got as fit as I could because the place was gigantic and I was always zipping back and forth, carrying so much weight. I got very thin that summer running all around that giant restaurant. I met some other actors from the USC drama program hanging out by the dorm pool. They were always just swimming and laughing and having barbecues and taking ecstasy on the weekends. There were visiting professors in the dorm, too, and I met a scientist in his early 50s who looked like Max von Sydow's character in Hannah and Her Sisters. He asked if I wanted to have coffee one day, and I was so lonely I responded really enthusiastically, "Please, I would love it. Let's have coffee." So we went to the Sizzler. He talked about science, and I was delighted. He was so sweet. He kept me company for a while just as a friend. I felt very anxious around the USC drama students. They were always relaxing and just like chilling by the pool, you know. Part of me wished I could be more like them, but then another part of me thought, gosh, they're kind of lazy. Like, how can they just hang out by the pool all day long, midday? There's so much work to be done. Shouldn't we all be passing out our headshots, taking advantage of our youth? We're young. Let's get these faces out there. I put my headshots in a bag and took the bus to Samuel French, a theatrical bookstore where you could buy plays and scripts and books about the acting business. I bought a paperback with agents' addresses in it, and then I would walk up and down Sunset Boulevard, slipping my picture under their doors. Then I would come home and swim and eat delicious baked potatoes with a side of vegetables for dinner every night in my furnished dorm room. Eventually, I got lonely enough I called my dad, who was so excited that I needed him that he came out for a visit. "I'll be right there," he said. He stayed with me for a week and rented a car so he could drop me off and pick me up for my shifts. I'd get in the car at night and count the money I had made, like $45, and he'd just say, "Yeah, you know, Molly, that's how you learn, you know. You gotta make your dollar and know the value of a buck, and that's the way it goes." I understood what he was trying to teach me. But a part of me wished that I could have been more like my barbecuing and partying neighbors. I felt like I was too rigid. So one night, I decided to go out with them. But after a few hours keeping up with them, I felt exhausted. I had to go to the bathroom, so this pair of girls I didn't know said, "Let's make a choo-choo train." So we all went together, putting our hands on each other's hips. They were so sweet. Chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga, choo-choo to the bathroom all together. And I felt this drunk love for them. But those kids did that all summer long, all the time. I partied with them once and I thought, I am never doing this again. I felt so dehydrated the next day, I wasn't willing to waste that kind of time. None of those people ended up making it. One afternoon, as I was going from building to building through the Beverly Hills part of Sunset, delivering my headshots, Gary Coleman's agent, Mark Randall, opened his door and invited me to come in. He was tall and very tan, dressed California casual. It was a large office with little teddy bears and other stuffed animals strewn about. The only photograph in the office was a gigantic portrait of Gary Coleman. Mark just happened to be there and took a meeting with me on the spot. He said, "Take a little spin. Let me see you." I did a spin for him. I was so naive. Then he said, "Now sit down. Tell me about yourself." I was dying. To me, this was big time. He said, "Listen, I'm going to help you out, okay? I'm going to introduce you to my friend who's a big soap opera casting director." I thought, oh my God, this is so exciting. Gary Coleman had just gotten off Different Strokes and was a big star. I was over the moon. If this man signs me, I thought, his clients will be me and Gary Coleman. I'll have a talent agent who represents Gary Coleman. Mark even said he would pay for new headshots, which was a huge deal because they were expensive. Then he invited me up to his big, fancy house in the hills of Los Feliz. A lot of girls seemed to live there with him. They all walked around in bikinis. He suggested I put on my bathing suit and get in his hot tub for my big headshot photo shoot, which I did. It was ridiculous. Me in a hot tub in a bathing suit? Oh my gosh, I still have the headshot somewhere. His house was huge, with a pool, a jacuzzi, and an unbelievable city view. Mark suggested we do some scenes together so I could practice my acting. He got out a script and we read together. Then, as part of one sexy scene, he reached over and started to unbutton my shirt. Coming from NYU Drama School and being a very serious actress into taking risks, I was up for anything. So I thought, yeah, go for it. Go ahead. Unbutton it. I really wanted to commit to the role. It was kind of like he was testing me to see how far he could push it. But then all of a sudden it just seemed so sleazy. I had to stop him. He played it cool and said, okay, and didn't push it any further. The only work Mark ever got me that summer was modeling for a hair show in Marina Del Rey. He drove all the live-in actresses and me to a salon in Beverly Hills, where a Japanese hairdresser made my hair into what looked like a big tidal wave. The actual show was a blur. I strutted down that runway and modeled my wave. When it was over, Mark took the girls and me out to the Cheesecake Factory in Marina Del Rey to celebrate. I made $100. But a few weeks later, in the fall of 1987, when I was back at school, I got a call from Mark. He said he was coming to New York City with Gary Coleman and asked if I wanted to meet them for tea at the Plaza Hotel. I was over the moon, meeting my West Coast agent at the Plaza Hotel. La-di-da! When I arrived, Gary stood up like such a gentleman and Mark sat next to him. After pushing in my chair, Gary held my hand.
He was 18 years old, but so little. I thought he was cute as a button. He was all dressed up in an expensive suit. He was also very flirtatious with me throughout the tea, saying, "You remind me of Kimberly from Different Strokes." I was flying with excitement. It was the biggest compliment. I loved Dana Plato. She was so cute and bubbly. I couldn't believe that I reminded Gary of his co-star. I was thinking, that means I can make it in Hollywood. Maybe I'll be on the next Different Strokes. Oh, if only I could be in her position. We had a great time laughing and joking. Then they asked me if I wanted to come up and see Gary's suite, which was the presidential suite on the top floor. I said, sure. Gary held my hand on the elevator. The suite was huge. Gary showed me around, and then when we got to his room, he closed the door and said, "Sit on my bed." I sat on his bed. From there, I had a view of his kidney dialysis machine in the corner. He hopped up on the bed next to me. The possibility of something sexual occurring hadn't even crossed my mind. I was an innocent virgin still, and I had just turned 22. He was playful at first, kind of tickling me and trying to lie on top of me and smooch me. Then when I pushed him away and stood up, Gary climbed up on the bed and jumped off, using it as a springboard to launch himself onto me, kissing me wildly and sticking his little hands under my shirt. But he was so little, I was able to just flip him back off onto the floor. It wasn't that hard. He bounced right back onto the bed and wrapped himself around me again. Bed jumping was clearly a technique for him. "Whoa," I said, "hey, come on. And I flipped him back off onto the floor. He got back up and came at me again. I shouted, "Come on, Gary, knock it off. I don't even know you." I was laughing nervously. When he started kissing my neck, I told him, "Okay, this is not funny, Gary." I threw him off again. This happened multiple times. I would throw him across the room, and he would use the bed to bounce right back on top of me. He kept bouncing back, and I kept flipping him off. It was exhausting. He would not give up. Finally, I started to walk away, and he changed strategies. He crawled back over, grabbing my ankle, wrapping his whole upper body around my calf, and then I was dragging him across the floor. As I walked, he held on tight. "No, Gary," I shouted. This time I had to shake him off my leg hard. Then I ran across the room and locked myself in the bathroom, out of breath. He followed, got down on the floor, stuck his hands under the door, and waved his fingers and said, "I can see you, silly Billy." What am I going to do? I wondered. My hair was all messy. I wanted to be on the next Different Strokes, but this was disturbing and sad and so awkward with his dialysis machine out there in the hotel room. Gary's relentlessness was unlike anything I'd ever experienced. While he was in the middle of this attack, I both couldn't believe what was happening to me and couldn't wait to tell my friends. I was already thinking about how I was going to tell them. I was turning it into a story as it was happening, but I was also genuinely shocked. Obviously, he assumed that I wanted to fool around because I came up to the hotel room, but he was so aggressive, it was crazy. I didn't run out until he stopped trying to get into the bathroom. I waited till he gave up, and he was so little, I didn't feel physically in danger. It didn't seem that threatening, more kooky than anything else. Then I dashed out fast, blurting, "I gotta go!" Once I made it out the door, Gary straightened up and acted like nothing had ever happened. I went out into the hallway and back down on the elevator and found Mark in the restaurant near the lobby. Unfortunately, I didn't say anything that strong to him. I just told him, "That client of yours is wild. You got to keep a lid on him. You have to watch that client of yours." I didn't say anything more. I never heard from Mark Randall after that. I told this whole story on Conan in the late 1990s while Gary was still very much alive. He never contacted or contradicted me. He knew what had happened. Chapter 11, The Mammoth Scam. When I was at NYU Drama School, you really weren't supposed to audition for anything outside of the drama program. They wanted their students to focus on their training. But I wanted to be a pro. I knew I was ready. So I auditioned on the side doing very dark, dramatic monologues. Oh, mommy, mommy, please don't burn me, mommy. The casting directors on a soap opera called Another World were absolutely thrilled. We want you on the show, they told me. So I got my first under five, the industry term for a role with less than five lines. This was promising, and I immediately bought into SAG. Now I was eligible for union jobs in dental care. I graduated from NYU in 1987 and stayed in New York for a year after that, trying to get more stuff cooking. My thinking was I'd give New York City a year and see if something happened, and then I'd try LA. I made a fake Actors Equity card that I used to sneak into professional Broadway auditions. One time I made it really far on my fake Equity card, down to the callbacks for this big Broadway musical called Smile, about teen beauty pageants. There had been an open call, which meant hundreds of people came in, and they narrowed it down to the final 20. Debbie Allen was slated to be the choreographer, and they told us you have to be able to sing and move well. Even though I wasn't a professional dancer, they wanted singers who could learn a basic dance routine, and I made it to the final 20. And for the next callback, Debbie Allen was there with all the producers, a long table of 10 people. When I came in, she said to me, "Okay, well, you made it this far, so now let's see your moves. What do you got for us?" Show her my moves. I thought, just make up any dance, just like freestyle? I just have to dance with no music? Yes, that is exactly what they wanted, and I had to do it for a full minute. I did some spins, I clicked my fingers, I did a little chasse, some leaps in the air, threw in a little robot, and then my big finish, freezing like a statue with jazz hands. They were not impressed. It was the worst. I did not get the part. I bought a cheap belted blue and white dress at Bolton's and wore it uptown to slide my headshots under the doors at agencies in this big building on West 57th Street. Then I took the bus back downtown and crossed my fingers, hoping someone would call me at my services number. I paid 10 bucks a month to this company where actual women at a switchboard would take down messages so you wouldn't miss out if someone was trying to call you with a job. Real old-timey. I would call in to see if I had any messages, and there was nothing sadder than hearing, "Nope, no messages." But one agency did call me in for an interview. I wore my Bolton's dress while an assistant videotaped me and asked me questions. Then the head of the agency watched the tape to see what I looked like on camera. As she studied me on the recording, she lit up a cigarette. She was just silently watching the video as she smoked. I sat there too, and we watched the video together. While she took drags on her cigarette and let out the smoke, she kept shaking her head. No, 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 no. I went from being really excited to riding a bus home in my cheap Bolton's dress with her cigarette smoke clinging to it, frozen, staring out the window, heart sinking, replaying the whole scene in my head, just feeling like the pits, thinking, this is awful. I got a real job as a booker for runway models at a big-time modeling agency. I figured since I had my NYU degree, I should get a serious 9-to-5 job. My boss, the main booker guy, would send me out into the lobby on Friday afternoons to check over models' lookbooks for our open calls. I had no idea what I was doing. I would say things like, "Ooh, this shot of you is absolutely stunning," as if I were some professional. But I just felt bad for the models. Then my friend Eugene Pack and I decided to move out to LA together to do our own shows and try to get on television. I did not want to go to LA by myself. I had done that the summer before and been so lonely. I knew if I went back to LA, I was going to go with a friend. So the two of us headed out west together. We sublet an apartment from someone Eugene knew in the Villa Elaine, right across from the El Pollo Loco on Fountain and Vine in Hollywood. Our first 2 months in Hollywood were definitely vacation months. We went swimming every single day under the palm trees and ate out all the time. Then we buckled down and started buying copies of Dramalog every week to look for open call auditions. I took out multiple cash advances on my credit card and rented a rec. Eugene rented a rec, too. My dad said, "That's life. It's tough, you know? You gotta figure it out." But after a while, he changed his mind and said, "I could buy you a car." I wanted a car, but I knew not to accept, because I knew that in some moment when he was in a bad mood about something, he'd turn it around and guilt me and say, "I paid for that car. That cost a lot of money." I wasn't falling into that trap. But I also think it was good of him to not just tell me, "Oh, Molly, here's a check." It kept me hungry, literally. I learned how to rely on myself. It's good when you're worried about paying your rent and you have to figure it out or work more or take more shifts or save or not spend as much. My dad wanted me to learn this, and I did. Eugene met a woman who worked as a headhunter for all the big talent agencies and movie studios. William Morris, Creative Artists Agency, ICM, and that was a big break. She liked us because we were smart NYU graduates, and she would send us out all over Los Angeles. We'd be up in the morning drinking our coffee and get a call. "Hey, Molly, can you go answer phones today?" And I would put on my skirt and my nice blouse and head over to CAA. I would buy business-looking clothes at thrift shops to look office professional. I was temping for the head of Warner Brothers when Goldie Hawn came in. She looked so pretty and young. And what was so interesting was that I could tell by the way she was looking in the mirror before the meeting that she was really nervous and had made a big effort to look super sexy for the studio head. She was really working it, and I just thought, what is she so worried about? She's Goldie Hawn! CAA was in a high-rise on Avenue of the Stars in Century City. For my lunch break, I went to a little windowless coffee shop in the basement, this dumpy place with sandwiches and a couple of four tops. One time a guy came in and I thought, I know that guy, he looks so familiar. We exchanged glances. Then I realized, oh my God, it's Charlie Sheen. He had a production company at Orion in the same building. He walked up to my table and said, "You mind if I join you?" I thought, no problem, Charlie. He sat down and he was so nice. He totally opened up to me. Becoming a semi-star was really overwhelming. I started drinking a lot during Wall Street because I couldn't deal with the girls and the exposure, he said. "That sounds hard," I said. "Yeah," he said. "I lost control. But now I'm down to 2 beers a day. "Oh, that's good," I told him. I thought, Charlie's so down to earth. Eugene would make me laugh so hard, telling me the most hilarious stories about this one agent who he temped for who made him go to the Cheesecake Factory and pick up her chocolate chip cheesecakes. Then he'd hear her talking on the phone saying, "Why am I so fucking fat? I'm such a fat fucking hog." That agent repped a hot up-and-coming actress who would come around on her way to Vegas and drop off these slobbering St. Bernards for Eugene to walk all around Beverly Hills. One of the big agencies started to hire me a lot because I was personable. They put me on the desks of 2 big agents. One would never ask me to do anything. He'd just smile and say, "Hey, Molly, you good?" Now he cracks up that I was his temp. The other had 2 full-time assistants, and one of them asked me, "Do you know how to roll calls?" I really wasn't sure what she was talking about, but I had the general idea, so I said, "Yeah, sure, yeah, I know how to roll calls. Absolutely. I can do that." "Okay, he's going to return calls after lunch and you got to just keep the calls rolling, you know? Like, you get him on the line and keep him rolling." "Sure, yeah. Okay," I said. She sent me into this huge, snazzy office. The agent had a little foam basketball and he was bouncing it against a wall with a headset on. Since he had about 30 calls to return, he had to do a new call every 4 minutes to get through them all in a couple hours. My job was to have 5 waiting on hold while he talked, lights blinking, so he could move quickly to the next call. Bounce and roll, bounce and roll, bounce and roll. At the time, he represented Sarah Jessica Parker and Robert Downey Jr., who happened to be dating. I sat quietly off to the side with him not even looking at me. When Sarah Jessica Parker came on the line, I passed the call over and he said, "Hey, SJ, what's going on?" I was thinking to myself, this is so great. He's actually talking to Sarah Jessica Parker from Square Pegs. This is so cool. This is the coolest. Then Sarah put him on with Robert Downey Jr. Hey, Downey man, how you doing? Cool, cool, cool. Yeah, yeah, yeah. All while shooting some hoops with his little basketball. He would do a quick little business in these calls like, so yeah, hey, they want to do a remake of this show from Denmark. I'm going to send you the script, okay, buddy? And I'm hearing what he's saying, and I'm thinking to myself, I am a spy. This is what people do. Wow, how the hell do you get up to this level? This shit is fascinating. But then he's giving me signals, circling his finger like, faster, faster, come on, keep it up, go, 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 keep it going, faster, faster. But I wasn't fast enough. I was not fast enough. Suddenly, I didn't have them lined up. I had nobody for him. I was in the middle of scrambling to quickly get somebody on the line when he literally kicked me out and hauled another assistant in mid-call. I was sent home. Right after that, an actor acquaintance from NYU got a part as a cashier on the sitcom Growing Pains. And I was so jealous. He had only been in LA for a few weeks. I thought, I wish I could get a job like that. He got a guest spot on a series. And even though it was so ridiculous that it was Growing Pains, I just couldn't get over it. How come he gets a part on Growing Pains and I get nothing? Why, God, why? This just isn't fair. Then my dad told me, remember, you can always come home anytime. I'll send you the money and the ticket. I was temping, I was broke, and I just thought, oh, this is so hard. I went out for a walk and cried, talking to God. It's just taking forever. I'm still really struggling. It's just not fair. But during that walk, suddenly I had an epiphany. I thought, at least I'm out here doing what I love, pursuing what I love, trying. So many people I'd gone to college with had given up on their dreams, and a lot of people from my high school had moved back to Ohio after college and weren't really pursuing what they wanted. I thought to myself, at least I'm in LA doing what I want. That alone is a very meaningful life. That's actually a good, brave thing, I thought. You're doing more than most people will ever do. I don't care if I keep trying till I'm 60. I'm going to try till I'm a grandmother, and I'm just going to enjoy the process. Yes, it's hard, but at least I'm out here doing what I want. That's a very good thing that most people aren't even brave enough to do. Now, 30 years later, that's still my spiritual business philosophy. Struggle itself is meaningful. You never know where anything is going to go. You just don't know. I didn't know if I would ever make it, but I have a positive attitude, and I think people always see that in me. And I still pursue show business that same way. Now, decades later, what I would tell actors struggling, auditioning for a part would be, don't worry so much about getting some part. You never know what exactly they're looking for, so don't take it so personally. Don't look at it like, I've really got to get this one part. Just look at it as a meeting. When I go for an audition, I try not to be result-oriented. Maybe you're not right for this part, but they'll remember you later for something else. You never know. Just think, hey, I got to meet this person. Look at it as laying down your groundwork, building your relationships, maintaining your relationships. Hollywood is so small, it's like a high school. The town can seem so overwhelming at first. Geographically, it's giant and spread out. But people are all connected. Everybody knows everybody. You always have to hustle no matter what level you're at, so you might as well enjoy where you are and not compare. I've seen people who are superstar movie stars who still feel like they are only as good as their last movie, and they are full of fear and insecurity, and I think, wait a minute, you're scared? Well, in that case, I better just enjoy where I am, because if you're scared, then we're all fucked. And then it's important to go to the people who love you and who want to work with you, as opposed to trying to convince people who don't. If there's some obstacle, maybe there's a reason for it. I always try to look at stuff that way. No matter how far you've come, what level of success you've achieved, you're always going to have to get to the next place, so you might as well enjoy where you are. Be creative and enjoy your work. Just enjoy the process. I try not to buy into the process that I don't measure up. To me, that's an old childhood pattern. Hollywood can sometimes make you feel like you're never enough with its ups and downs, but I try hard to enjoy life on Earth as an artist. It makes me feel good when people come up to me and say, you make me so happy. Oh, you really make us laugh. That's really what it's all about, making people feel good. It's not about yourself. I like to think about what movies and storytelling do for people and how you can make people forget their troubles. I like the extension of myself. You can show an audience how a character is feeling. They are with you. And then maybe they can understand a part of themselves through the character or performance. In 2003, I did this TV series called Cracking Up. It was created by my good friend, the dazzling Mike White, a writer, director, performer I worship. But the network didn't get behind the show. They kept trying to get Mike to change it, and it was not a good experience for him. We shot 13 episodes and only 2 aired, but Mike and I became really good friends. We'd have dinners and he'd say, "I'm going to write you a movie." And I'd think, "You are? Ooh, that would be great." I was so excited, but I also didn't want to ask him about it or bother him too much because I know how hard he worked, and I knew that the whole experience on Cracking Up was really difficult. So I thought, if he does this, it should just be creative and no pressure, and he should just have fun writing. And then one day he called me up and said, "I have a script to send you." And it was like a dream come true, a movie for me. I opened it up, and it said Year of the Dog by Mike White. A movie I never would have gotten offered in mainstream Hollywood. But because Mike knew me personally, he believed I could play the part. Financiers signed on, but their money came with a list of actresses they wanted for the lead. Mike told them, "I wrote the movie from Molly and only want to do it with Molly." After that, Brad Gray, the head of Paramount, read the script and was interested. Mike told Brad he only wanted me, and Brad said, "Great, I love Molly." And that was that. I went home for Christmas and my dad flew into a rage while I was helping with the cooking. It was a big scene. He screamed, "You ruined the gravy!" Whenever he used to yell like that, I'd be really scared. But this time, instead of taking it, I just came right back at him. It was like that movie This Boy's Life, when he finally stood up to his stepdad and fired back and decided he was just not going to take his shit anymore. I got in his face and I said, "Don't you talk to me like that. Don't you dare." I fought back. I finally stood up for myself. And he was scared. I made him cry. I thought, God, I should have done this a long time ago. At home, a lot of invoices had piled up for the student loans I had taken out to go to NYU. As I was opening them up and asking myself how I was ever going to pay, my dad told me I didn't have to worry. He said, "Oh, they don't keep track of that." So I took my invoice and ripped it up into tiny little pieces and I threw it in the air saying, "Whee!" I saw Debbie Palermo when I was home. She wanted to find a job in casting, so she came to visit me in Los Angeles and decided to stay. I've been living in Burbank with my friend Lynn Henderson, an actress I first met in New York City and re-met at the SAG Bulletin Board in L.A. Deb moved in with us. Then her brother, Mike, followed her out and still lives there. He told me recently, "The only reason why I lived in L.A. was because you lived here already and encouraged me to pursue acting when I graduated high school." Even though Debbie was the first one to suggest I become an actor, it wasn't until Christmas of '88, when you were home for vacation and you, Deb, and I met for coffee on the East Side, you saw my modeling photos and told me I should come to L.A. Debbie ended up getting a job working for Madonna. Lynn worked the night shift at Jerry's Famous Deli, and together during the day, Lynn and I started fragrance modeling all over town. We'd stand by the escalators at the Sherman Oaks Galleria or some other mall, wherever our booker would send us, all over greater Los Angeles. For one campaign, we dressed up like newsies with caps and shoulder bags and shouted, "Extra, extra, read all about it. You want to try a spritz of this new fragrance? Notes of pepper and vanilla. You'll get compliments." I prayed that I wouldn't bump into anyone I knew in my little newsboy outfit. But I discovered after a month or so that the booking agent never knew whether or not I actually stayed for my shift. She just checked to make sure I showed up at the store. Once I figured this out, I would sign in, wander out into the mall, find a bookstore and read for a couple hours, or I would check in and then leave after 15 minutes. Then I just stopped going at all. This was great until the booker found out. She called and confronted me asking, "Were you there, point blank?" "Nordstrom just called and said nobody showed up." "Yeah, I was there." "Molly, Were you or were you not at the Santa Ana Nordstrom for your shift? I broke down. No, Sharon, I wasn't. I'm sorry. Molly, why would you say that? Why would you say that you were there when you weren't there? Sharon, I don't know. Because I'm a bad girl. I'm a very bad girl. After that, Eugene Pack and I both tented a fancy boutique literary agency on Beverly Drive. They had files on all of their authors, where they liked to eat, what they did in their free time, what they liked to talk about, their spouses' names, so that when the agents took them to dinner, they would have a fun conversation. There were hundreds of interesting realities I learned while temping. There were hand signals for take a message and be there in 2 minutes or just get rid of them. All the while, we were trying to figure out how we were going to get in the door as actors. How in the hell were we going to bust in? It was too hard to just slip your picture under an agent's door, a random headshot. No one was ever going to call. Then we hit on an idea. Eugene had studied with David Mamet. He was and is this giant, hugely successful guy, very respected, a big-time playwright and screenwriter. But Eugene knew that he wasn't a guy who was in Hollywood much. He just liked staying in Vermont and New York. We had all these people we wanted to meet in L.A. Commercial agents, theatrical agents, casting directors. We wanted to be sent out on auditions. So this one Friday, we thought of this scam while we were sitting on the floor in the apartment in Burbank I shared with Lynn and Debbie. We decided we would call agents pretending that we worked for David Mamet. First, we did our research. We went to the American Film Institute library and looked up managers and agents we thought would be good for us in this big, thick agency book. We also looked up actors we thought were like us, found out who managed them, and decided to go after these people and try to get them to sign us by pretending to be representing Mamet. I called it the Mamet Scam. For the Mamet Scam, Eugene's fake name was Arnold Katz. And my fake name was Liz Stockwell. And as these characters, we called agents, always on Fridays after 4 because we knew they'd be in good moods. It's Friday, it's after lunch, everybody's happy, getting ready for the weekend, heading to Palm Springs. Suddenly, Mamet's thinking about them. They are delighted. I'd say, yes, this is Liz Stockwell calling from David Mamet's office. I was David Mamet's right-hand girl. I was a ray of sunshine, a fun, positive gal. They would say, oh, 1 minute, and put me directly through to the agent we were pursuing. Then when I got the agent on the phone, I would say, I have this young kid named Eugene Pack that I think you might like. Flattered that David Mamet was interested in them, they'd all say, oh my God, we are so honored that you called us. And with the upper hand, I would go on. Well, you know, David speaks so highly of your agency, and we have this young kid who's part of our theater company who David would love for you to meet. David asked me to call you specifically, and we'd love for you to meet this kid who's really special, who you should definitely have your eye on. And they would say, of course, of course, of course. Our experiences in selling health club memberships really helped us with the scam. We knew how to turn a no into a yes. We had it so down that we knew exactly what to say. And we had a rule where you couldn't hang up the phone till you had the appointment in the book. If there was an obstacle, we had an answer, just like in sales. In the Mamet scam, there was an answer for everything. Whatever the problem was, we'd find a way to jump over it. We had it all figured out. If an agent said, well, why don't you have Eugene call me when he gets to town? I would say, Eugene's really busy right now. He's rehearsing David's new play. I would make him the star of the new play. Oh, Eugene's running around having so many meetings. Listen, why don't we just set up the appointment now to make it easier on him so he doesn't have to be worried about that? He's only out here for a few days. He has so many meetings that I just want to take care of it now. And they'd be thinking, ooh, who is this hot new up-and-coming actor? It was just like selling health club memberships. Don't you fucking hang up that phone till you get that credit card number. We were closing. We were finessing the deal as we went along. We had to get the appointment in the books. We could not be in the same room while we were on the phone because we would crack each other up. But when I was making my calls, Eugene would listen from the outside of the door and slide me little notes, and I would do the same thing for him. We started to get so good at the scam. They would say, "Liz, when you come to town, we should have lunch. What's your number?" And I would say, "Oh, I would love to have lunch. We're actually switching offices, but as soon as we're set up, I will have my assistant call you and we'll get something in the books." I never had to give them my number. This is how I got my start in Hollywood. I would get Eugene a bunch of appointments and he would get me a bunch of appointments. By Friday at 6 o'clock, we would both have 5 appointments. Our agreement was that we had to have an equal number set up. We started meeting everyone. Agents at ICM, William Morris. I wanted to be on Twin Peaks, so Eugene called the casting director, Joanna Ray, and I actually did get cast on Twin Peaks through the Mammoth scam. The casting director had an English accent, and when I met her, she just said, "Wonderful, it's so nice to meet you. I must introduce you to David Lynch." Which was exactly what I wanted to have happen. Because I would drive my rent-a-rack past her casting office and say, "Oh, I really want to be on Twin Peaks. I love that show." Then she brought me in to audition for Caleb Deschanel, who was the director, and he cast me as Judy Swain, the happy helping hands caseworker. Eugene also called Bernie Brillstein for me. I wanted to meet Bernie because he was a legend and connected to Lorne Michaels of Saturday Night Live. Bernie said, "How is David? Oh, wonderful. Give him my best, Liz." Bernie then introduced me to his daughter, Lee, who was a big agent at ICM. At that time, I thought the Brat Pack was the coolest. I wanted to be part of the Brat Pack. I wanted to meet Molly Ringwald. So I really wanted to meet their hot talent manager who repped all of them. We ran the Mammoth scam on her and set up a meeting. I got all dressed up and was so excited. When I sat down for my appointment, she glared at me and said, "I just wanted to see what a liar looked like in person." My heart was pounding. I was in a panic. I had to figure out something quick. I said really naively, "Sorry, I don't know what you're talking about." She said, "Your little friend Arnold Katz called me. You know, this guy's like a total scammer." I just played really innocent. "What? I don't know what you're talking about." She kept glaring. And when I still didn't crack, she said, "Can I ask you a question? Are you dating this guy?" I just went with it. "I am, actually. We've only been dating for a few weeks. He just said he could help me out, and he knows a lot of people in town." She nodded. "Honey, I gotta tell you something. This guy is like a scum bucket. He's a scam artist, you understand? He doesn't know anybody, okay?" "Really?" "Yeah, really. This guy's full of shit. Trust me, he can't help you." I ran out so fast and called Eugene from a payphone. We just got so busted. It was the only time we got busted, though. Mammoth was perfect because everybody knew him, but nobody ever saw him. We knew there was never going to be a cross-check. I haven't ever told this story because I was always afraid I'd get in trouble. But this is how I started in Hollywood. We ran the Mammoth scam for about 6 months. And the way we saw it, we were doing them a favor because they were getting to meet good, up-and-coming actors. Later, if I didn't think my agents were sending me out enough, I would say, "Eugene, we got to get together on Friday and make some calls and get more cooking." Maybe more women need to push the rules to get to the yes to even out the biased playing field in Hollywood. Chapter 12. Comedy is King. Working in offices from 9 to 5 wasn't so great for auditioning, and I was getting sick of being indoors and never seeing the sunshine. I started to drive around looking at restaurants and wondering, what would it be like to work there? So I decided to make the switch. The hours were more flexible. Cravings was in a great location on Sunset Boulevard in West Hollywood. They had lots of outdoor seating and live piano music. When I filled out an application, the owner's wife, Gretchen, was seating customers, and she interviewed me right at the hostess stand. Gretchen also happened to be from Shaker Heights. She said, "Oh my God, you're from Cleveland?" And I was hired. I also moved out of the apartment I'd been sharing with Lynn and Debbie Palermo in Burbank and in with a new roommate, a super Irish-looking, outgoing guy with freckles and pale skin, Brian Donovan. Brian had this appealing, scratchy voice and got a lot of work doing voiceovers for animation and commercials. At Cravings, my hostess stand was right out there on the sidewalk so I could watch everyone who walked by. I loved being around people. The restaurant was part indoors and part outdoors, so it was always sunny and bright, and I loved listening to the piano when I worked at night. The boss, Ibrahim, was tough and Turkish and took away my Saturday nights. He was maybe 5'2", a short, powerful guy with a sweet side and a self-loathing side, and a notion of how things should be done. He wanted his employees to look a certain way, hair pulled back, nice outfits, clean, and put together. And to get results, he could be tough. He would say exactly what he was thinking. What is this? You dress like this? And fire employees right on the spot. If he really needed some leverage, he would say, I've been getting complaints about you. As Ibrahim said those cutting things, he would look right at you. And then he would scoff, mumbling under his breath, you have to get better clothes. We were all a little scared of him, but it was such a good job that nobody wanted to leave. I needed that job. I wrote to Allison in Cleveland about it. Debbie is $10,000 in debt. She's thinking of declaring bankruptcy. I'm at least $20,000 in debt with my student loans. Scary. So whenever you start feeling bad about money problems, call me or Debbie. Last night, my boss at Cravings told me, A, that I needed to wear nicer clothes to work, B, that he'd gotten complaints about me. As he was telling me this, I kept thinking, ugh, I'm going to quit right now. But I swallowed my pride. It was terrible. I can't afford to quit. I must continue subjecting myself to his moodiness. I am such a prisoner. I felt like such a loser. Loser! I'm sorry this letter is so depressing, but facts are stubborn things. Of course I blame my fate or myself and no one else, and I will pick myself up out of this downward spiral. When Ibrahim made me the hostess, I knew it meant he thought of me as capable and strong. I was happy, and I felt honored to have that position, though I also felt guilty because the waiters would have to tip me out. Of course, he told me, since I'm making you the hostess, you need to wear nicer clothes. There was always that element of fear I wrote to Allison about. After I bought these clothes, the busboys in the kitchen said, oh, mommy, you look nice like that. You look real nice, like a Mexican mommy. They would also grab me. I liked it. I just thought, wonderful, sweet. They appreciate women and women's bodies. They love women. They like asses and stomachs. I do not see it that way now, but at the time it made me feel sexy. By today's standards, it was misogynistic, but back then calling a girl mommy and commenting on her figure was the same as giving her flowers. As the hostess, my post was outside where I looked at the restaurant across the street, Le Petit Four. Ibrahim would always take note of how packed they were. They were his competitors. One day, a woman came in 20 minutes before her lunch reservation. I recognized her right away. Wow, I thought, it's Jennifer Aniston. She was striking. Long hair, perfect blowout, crystal blue eyes, beautiful outfit. I was enamored. This was right before Friends, when she was just on the verge of breaking out, doing tons of pilots. Lorne Michaels was after her for SNL, too. I was a little hostess from Cleveland, and she was this up-and-coming star. I was so impressed. I wanted to know how she did it. How was she able to orchestrate her career with such self-assurance at such a young age? And what I noticed was that she was all business. She'd come early because she wanted to make sure she had the right table, in the corner. She set it up for all her agents, and once they arrived, she held court. Studying her, I thought, wow, self-made, hardworking, getting things done, just a hot little tamale around town. Telly Savalas was her godfather, too. Another time at Cravings, Julia Roberts came in for breakfast with a friend. She looked stunning, just like she did in the movies. But she just ordered sausage. Interesting, I thought, just sausage. superstars eat sausage. Good to know. I thought a lot about it. Maybe she'd had another breakfast earlier. There was a lot of thinking about Julia Roberts' breakfast. Brooke Shields also used to come into Cravings with her mom, Terry, who'd gotten her daughter cast in the role of the prostitute in Pretty Baby when she was 12. When I was a teenager, there was a photo book I love called The Brooke Book, which showed Brooke going around to her modeling go-sees, and I realized her mother was her talent manager, her momager. I thought, I need a momager like Terry Shields to get me out on the town. My dad didn't know much about that, but he did a little research and said he would try to make a few calls. He got in touch with this agent, Bill Block, at ICM. Unfortunately, at the time, Bill Block was a literary agent. Now he's a big producer. Still, my dad got me a meeting at ICM just cold calling. And then he got me in the door at Young and Rubicam, an ad agency, but it just wasn't the right place. Terry Shields was also a drinker, which was interesting. At Cravings, I would watch her order Chardonnay in the afternoon. One of Brooke's later books was about what a bad alcoholic her mother was. At Cravings, I had the most fun with my coworkers, Jim and Jimmy, cool guys who were in a band together. Both of them were much more than just cool, actually. They were sweet and thoughtful and poetic, and they loved to have fun. We'd come in and eat dinner before our shift since it was free, and the creamy chicken Alfredo was so good. We would have parties after work at night. Cravings was like a family, and we really bonded and had so much fun working together. I had a big crush on Jimmy, who would arrive on a motorcycle for the dinner shift and change into whites for Ibrahim. He was blonde, with serious eyes and a kind face. Very sweet and gentle, but also funny. Dry, cerebral funny. Jimmy took a real liking to my dad when he came out to LA for a visit and invited the two of us out to dinner. Jim, who was very tall, with red hair, and both his ears and nose pierced, took his station up front behind a deli counter. He operated the cash register, made salads, and did all the coffees. Jim was on this diet called Fit for Life, eating nothing but fruit all day and then carbs for dinner. It was a popular diet back then. As I was running back and forth seating people, I'd pause for a sec to talk with Jim. We'd play the dirty question game. Molly, if your boyfriend asked you to lick his asshole, would you? I hurried back outside and thought about it as I was seating people. Then I came back to the deli counter. If I loved him and he showered first, sure, I'd lick it, I said. Emir, one of Ibrahim's Turkish friends, was older than the rest of us, late 30s, and would do anything to make people laugh. And unlike the rest of us waiters, Emir had impunity with Ibrahim. He could pretty much do whatever he wanted. Emir was funny. Ibrahim, my brother, he'd shout while the rest of us were bustling around and worrying about our hair and outfits. Emir worked double shifts to make extra money, so between lunch and dinner, he had to just kill time in the neighborhood. He spent a lot of time in his car. Then he would come in and say, I napped, I masturbated. Emir was like a clown, an Arlecchino. Cravings was a fucking joy. I loved that place. It was hard for me to leave that place. I signed up for improv classes at Second City in Santa Monica, and that's where I met my friend Rob Muir. He was kind of a jock, very all-American and down-to-earth. We're still close friends. We just clicked, and he quickly became almost like a brother and an amazing writer partner. We decided to invite some others from the class and started putting together a comedy group. We started improvising one day a week, coming up with scenes and characters, and started writing a show. We would meet in my little apartment in Hollywood, and Rob told me something that made a huge impression. You know, he said, comedy is king. I said, is it? Is comedy king? Yes, it is. The best way to get into show business is through comedy. Oh, but I'm a dramatic actress. Then I molded over and realized I believed him. Okay, I thought, comedy is king. When we decided to put on a show, we called ourselves the Lumber Company. Then Debbie Palermo, who was working in casting on the Warner Brothers lot at the time, told this young agent who she'd really connected with, Stephen Levy, that he needed to come see her best friend, Molly. She knew I needed representation, and she thought he would be the perfect fit. They came to see the show, and Stephen found me afterward. You should be on SNL, he said. He begged me, please come have a meeting with me. I did. The agency where he worked was called Herb Tannen and Associates. When I got there, I noticed that everything was little. In the waiting room, they had these tiny red chairs, and the tables were so low my knees towered above them. Sitting on these little tables were copies of Highlights magazine. Herb Tannen and Associates was a children's agency. Stephen came into the waiting room and said, let's go out on the patio and talk. We did. And as he smoked cigarette after cigarette, he told me, yes, this is a children's agency, but I've been asked by Herb to start an adult division. I think you should be on SNL, and I'm going to get you there. I saw that he was really passionate and that he believed in me. When I met Stephen, I thought to myself, gosh, this guy could do business in a phone booth. He didn't even need a fancy office. So I signed on as his client. And it turned out that he did have one other adult client, Brad Garrett, who was a stand-up comedian and went on to be a regular on Everybody Loves Raymond. Then the lumber company got a review in Backstage and I was singled out. That was very exciting. So Rob and I decided to branch out and do our own show, just the two of us. We called it the Rob and Molly Show. At first, we took turns performing. He would do a character, I would do a character. But over time, it was Rob who wanted the show to focus more on me, something that I never would have pushed for myself. But he helped me take that space. As Rob wrote me recently, in our comedy group, you stood out because you weren't doing jokes. You were doing characters, not caricatures. Sure, some of your characters were over the top, but they were always rooted in truth. You not only found the humor in the character, but humanity. You weren't afraid to take a break from the comedy and explore the bittersweet sadness in the character. Then, once you pulled the audience in, you turned on a dime and surprised them with something quirky and offbeat. No one else was doing that kind of comedy. It was brave and unapologetic. You weren't about zingers and catchphrases. You dug deep and created three-dimensional characters. I always thought you were a cross between Carol Burnett and Gilda Radner. You were fearless and willing to take chances, always pushing the boundaries. I wanted to team up with you for three reasons: your infectious energy, your passion and work ethic, and lastly, you love to play on stage. Performers have different reasons for being on stage, but to me, it seemed like you were there to play and have fun, and that's what we did. I thought the show should focus on you because you were something unique. Not a lot of women at the time were really willing to let their guard down. You could be dark and edgy, lewd and crude, totally outrageous. You didn't care about how you appeared on stage because it wasn't you. You weren't playing a part, you became the character. Your performances were riotously funny. I remember when you were doing Mary Catherine one night and you cut your hand on stage, you never stopped, didn't even pause. You were so deep in the character that you just went on. There was an electricity when you hit the stage. Nothing was predictable. The audience, even me sometimes, never knew what was going to happen next. I knew you were headed for great things and I wasn't going to get in the way. I remember before our shows became popular, you were thinking of going back to doing theater and I said, no, comedy is king. In the early 90s, there weren't any females doing the kind of character comedy you were doing. I knew if you could be seen by the right people, you'd be on your way. The show was a tight 50 minutes. You're in and out. I figured people were busy. Agents were busy. I thought about their long days working at the office. They were on the phone all the time, so I was constantly thinking about how to cater to them to get them to my show, thinking about their lives. My goal was for just one industry person to come per show, a realistic goal. We made the show very friendly for business people. I would think about them coming home from work and wanting to relax and have fun, so we'd always serve alcohol. We had a saxophone player and a keyboard player accompanying us. I paid for the music with my hostessing money. We made it like a party at a convenient time so people would drive straight from their offices in Beverly Hills. I would just think about making it fun. You get to come, watch a show, have a glass of wine, go meet a friend for dinner after the show. Easy peasy. Don't bore them with some long show. And that formula, I have to say, did work. I would pack the house myself. I would tell every single customer I met at Cravings, oh, you've got to come see my show. I'd ask, what's your name? Oh, Jamie? Okay. And what's your boyfriend's name? Ben? Okay. Oh, my God. Oh, Ben's a lawyer? And I would take notes. And since this was before email, I kept a big box of names and phone numbers. So when I did a show, I got on the phone and started dialing and dialing and did not stop. I would call and say, "Hi, Jamie. This is Molly. Yeah, I met you at Cravings. I'd love for you and your boyfriend Ben to come see my show." I would make 500 calls to get 200 people to come and hustle and tell everyone I met, "You gotta come see my show." And I would pack the house so it would look like a good, hot show for the industry people who came. There was nothing more important than packing the house. Pack it, pack it, pack it, pack it. One night, I met this vivacious and funny woman named Lisa Sunstedt at a party. So I invited her to the show, and not only did she come, but she flipped for it, and from then on would spread the word and invite so many people. It was Lisa who introduced me to these three guys who sang R&B a cappella together under the name TMT. I ended up putting them in the show, and the audience loved them. And Lisa and I became good friends. I also invited homeless people. Everybody should be allowed to come, I thought. Stephen Levy remembers that there were homeless people with no teeth who would come and say to him when he was working the door, "Molly invited us to the show. We're here for Molly." I was always nice to people who collected cans and asked for food, and they would take the bus to see my show. Debbie Palermo came to every single one of my shows. She was always so encouraging and supportive. I included little inside jokes for her, and her brother Mike could always calm me down before I performed, telling me not to worry. He'd take me to Denny's and we'd talk it out. He was a constant support. Once before one of my stage shows, Deb saw me on the street and said, "There she is, superstar." It became a refrain. And from then on, I would always say, "Superstar," to her because I knew she loved it. She coined it. And if people couldn't afford to buy a ticket, I would pay for their ticket. I was really into creative visualization. I thought someday the money's going to come back to me. I believed if I put it out, it would come back to me tenfold. And on the flip side, deep down, I was petrified. I had a fear that everything was going to blow up the way it had when I was little. I was afraid that anything good was not going to last. Oh my God, I'm not going to be able to do my show because what if my tooth starts throbbing and then I'm going to need instant dental surgery and then I won't be able to do the show and I'll have to cancel it. I remember driving to the West Side on the 10 freeway with my wigs in the back seat, and I was nervous. Doing these shows was a lot of pressure. So to be on the safe side, I would sometimes invite my dentist, Dr. Karen Nakagawa, to some of my shows just in case I needed an emergency root canal. It calmed me down just knowing she was in the audience. She didn't always come, but when she did, she was like a talisman and an excellent dentist. We made Mary Catherine Gallagher, an actress auditioning for a new David Lynch movie. I'd do a free-form improv as this character trying to get cast in the movie, and Rob's character would try to get me off stage after I got too crazy. My audition outfit was a blue and white striped t-shirt, cat glasses just like Anne Ramp's, red Keds, and a red headband. I combined how I felt when I was little with what Anne physically looked like, with her lazy eye and her eye patch. And in my mind, Mary Catherine Gallagher is an adult child of an alcoholic who always feels like she's in trouble. I would do wild stuff, physical stuff. It was like punk rock. I wanted to hurt myself. I was in a reckless stage of my life. Sometimes I would climb the walls or cut my leg and bleed, and I would always bruise myself. I liked being roughed up. I would get so into the performances that I couldn't feel any pain. I made my entrance by tripping over a folding chair, which I'd pick up and drag toward center stage to announce, "Hi, I'm Mary Catherine Gallagher." There were certain physical beats that I always followed and improvised around. After the chair, I'd be very bashful. So Rob would prod me by saying, "Go ahead, Mary. Step out in front and tell us who you are." Then I'd tell Rob, "My grandmother says that I bear a very striking resemblance to a young Elizabeth Taylor," which my dad actually told me. So my dad was the grandmother, and I'd do a dramatic monologue. Then I'd say, "You know, I can do gymnastics," and I would jump in the air and do a split. But then I'd get too carried away, and he'd have to scold me, "Mary, Mary Catherine Gallagher, you get down from that scaffold right this minute." And it would fucking kill. The audience would go nuts. They loved that I didn't care about bruising myself or making myself bleed. I just committed with my full heart. I don't like it when performers act like they are making fun of their characters. I believe that even with comedy, you should still play the emotional truth of what your character wants and who they are, because it anchors the comedy and gives it an emotional depth that makes the comedy stronger and richer. I treat the comedy the same way I would treat a serious dramatic performance. I got a very positive response from my show. People would come up after and say, "I loved your show." But I always felt like there was an ache in my heart, like someone was missing. My mom. There was this longing, a terrible ache. I couldn't quite be happy. I couldn't take it in that people liked it. I was driven to keep doing the shows and to work harder and harder. Thanks to Stephen, Saturday Night Live asked for a 5-minute tape of my characters. He had gotten out the word. I said, "Wait, why do they need a tape? Can't they just come see the show?" "No, they want a tape." So I used all my waitressing money and I made a tape. I worked very hard on it, paying a guy to direct and edit it, and didn't have much money after. And I knew a couple of other comedy women whose tapes were being sent in. I remember being on a payphone near my apartment on Fountain and Vine, across from the El Pollo Loco, when Stephen said the words, "Lorne Michaels is going to pass." I was devastated. I just cried and cried. But now I'm sure Lorne never even saw that tape. When Stephen told me who they had picked to audition for Lorne, I just thought, oh, whatever. I guess her tape was better. Then I thought, you know what? I'm just going to work really hard on my show, develop an arsenal of characters, so that when SNL comes back around again, I'm going to be locked and loaded and ready. And it does show that everything happens for a reason, because I feel like if I'd gotten SNL at that time, it wouldn't have been right, because it wasn't the best time for women. Chapter 13, SNL. After I'd gotten passed over, I continued developing and writing my stage show. I worked on an old character named Ruby Daly, who had a brace on her leg and was obsessed with Natalie Wood, and Sally O'Malley, who was a combination of my dad and a woman from my neighborhood growing up, and a little Miss Patty and Miss Jackie, the choreographer sisters. She sang "Hello, Dolly" as a tribute to the memory of her dead husband, Jack O'Malley. The love Sally O'Malley expressed for Jack was actually me thinking about how much I loved and adored my dad. I would buy a fresh, black, pre-teased wig from the same wig woman on Vine Street in Hollywood before each show. I also bought red polyester pants at a thrift shop and a yellow shirt. I would pull the red pants up really high and stick my stomach out. This got a really big laugh, and I thought people were laughing at my stuck-out stomach, but then I realized they were actually laughing at the ancillary camel toe created by the pants hiking. It was an accident, and I felt a little embarrassed, but I decided to keep it in because it really got laughs. I also kept working on Mary Catherine, honing the character, taking notes, paying attention to what got a laugh, what didn't work. I wrote from within. The character is basically an exaggerated version of myself as a kid, as a teen girl. I was always really focused on what I was learning as a comedian. I learned the character in front of the audience. I wanted to develop, develop, develop. After each show the next day, I'd walk around the block and review the whole performance in my head, revising according to how the audience had responded to every joke, and I would keep adjusting it, going through each beat. A process I think of as oral writing. Then I'd actually write out notes and follow them for the next live show. One time, while performing Mary Catherine Gallagher, I said, "Sometimes when I get nervous, I stick my fingers under my arms and I smell them like that. But that's bad." Which was based on something that really happened. Anne Rampt and I were in West Palm Beach on vacation by the pool at the Holiday Inn. I noticed that my armpits smelled, and we had this real teen puberty moment together where we said to each other, "Can I smell yours? I want to, and you can smell mine." And I thought, note to self, okay, good, that got a laugh. So it became a part of my performance, which always followed the same structure. Shy, warms up, goes crazy, gets sent away. But in the end, she would get the part. It was like a little dance of hope. Mary Catherine's trying really hard, then she gets too carried away. She misbehaves and sabotages herself. The auditioner sends her away. But then he decides, you got the part, and she succeeds. The original sketch was a little dance of survival. I was always taking notes about how Mary Catherine Gallagher should act, little rules for myself. From one of those notebooks, she enters from the doorway tripping over a chair. She falls. She drags the chair. She feels embarrassed. With her head down, she puts the chair back in its proper place. She introduces herself, Mary Catherine Gallagher, 3 times. Pick a moment to look at the audience, scared, cry, shake. Really look at the audience when you are shy. She hides behind the auditioner. He forces her to come out to the front. He says sweet things to encourage her. She keeps her head down and shakes. Shy, 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 almost starting to cry. She puts her hands and fingers under her underarms and then smells her fingers, sticking them in her nostrils. She squeezes her boobs nervously. She says, when I get nervous, I touch my boobs. She picks and pulls at her underwear. Slowly gets warmed up. Story about grandmother, kids making fun of me, saying, here comes Mary Catherine Gallagher and her dumb, crippled grandmother. She says, my grandmother tells me I bear a very striking resemblance to a young Elizabeth Taylor. Does gymnastics. Auditioner asks if she has a song. She sings Sometimes When We Touch. Gets too carried away. She gets stuck on a wall. I'm stuck, I'm stuck. He gets her down. He says, you are very bad. I'm writing your name down. Somewhere around here, she exits, realizing she has gotten out of control. After she's gone, the auditioner says, let's take a break. Important. Stakes should be high. What she wants is like life or death. The audience must know what she wants, what her heart desires. While I worked on my stage show, I was also auditioning for TV, usually best friend parts on series. I got rejected a lot, like a lot. The casting directors for those shows didn't seem to know what to do with me. With so much rejection, I was getting disillusioned about the town and how hard it all was. But deep down, I knew I was right for something more than just playing some supportive best friend part on TV. Oh, don't worry. He's going to call you back. I just know it. There were 300 actresses with pretty curls who had mommies who could do that. What I really wanted to do was the type of comedy I was developing in my stage show. When I auditioned for Tropicana Pure Premium Orange Juice, I did a version of Sally O'Malley from my stage show for the audition, and that landed me a national commercial. The role was a diner waitress serving customers orange juice. After I poured, they said, this sure tastes like fresh squeezed orange juice. And as a diner waitress, I replied deadpan, nope, it's Tropicana Pure Premium. I wrote a letter to a friend saying, my Tropicana commercial is running. It makes me look fat. They shot it from under my chin, and when I first saw it, I secretly hoped it wouldn't run. But now I'm happy, and I like doing characters. I don't want to be one of those actresses who has to be worried about getting old and looking good. I decided I didn't want to focus too much on auditioning, because they weren't really getting what I did. I wanted to focus on writing and creating original characters. And because it was so hard for me to get cast in the best friend roles, I felt so much urgency when it came to creating original material to put in my show. I figured if you are a woman who knows how to write, that's better, because then you aren't just waiting to fit into something that somebody else wrote that might not even be right for you. Better to just write your own material. Comedy could also be a boys' club. That was a frequent criticism. But I just thought, why are these comedy girls putting up with these little parts? Just go create your own material. Otherwise, you're going to play these dumb little nothing roles in these boys' comedy shows. I'm not going to do that. That's not going to get me anywhere. The struggle forced me to create my own work. It felt very empowering to stop relying so much on auditions. If I had gotten one of those TV jobs as the best friend on some multicam sitcom, I never would have pushed myself to create my own work and develop my stage show. So it ended up being positive, this struggle, never having an easy time. I got little parts here and there, and I did eventually get a development deal out of my stage show from Carolyn Strauss at HBO. I was thrilled. Carolyn was my first big supporter. But then that ended up falling apart, and I just remember thinking, oh, this is so fucking hard. I was starting to question everything. I don't know if I have the heart to do this, I thought. A casting director, Kathleen Lettery, called me in for an audition. She had helped me get a part on the John LaRoquette show a few years earlier. When I went in this time, she said, "Oh, Molly, you really need a break. You've been around town for a while." Ugh, it was rough to hear, but I thought, she's right. I finally quit Cravings after 4 years because I realized I was getting too associated with the place. I got so well known around LA as the hostess there that people would shout, "Grilled lemon chicken salad," when they saw me. I thought, okay, I've been here 4.5 years and I think I'm ready to leave. I'm going to do it. I'm going to take a chance. I'm going to give my notice. I didn't really have anything specific lined up. I was getting some parts, but still it wasn't like a guarantee. I knew it was the right time to just take a chance and leave. It was a big thing to leave a place that had been stable for me for so many years. When I went up to Ibrahim's office and told him that I was leaving, he gave me this look. He knew that we had had some tough times. "Molly," he said. Then he knelt down and kissed my hands. "Thank you, Ibrahim," I said. After that, I drove to Pan Pacific Park and listened to In Your Eyes by Peter Gabriel over and over again on my Sony Walkman. It was really windy. I kept rewinding the song. I could feel that change was in the air. There was a kind of magic in the night, one of those nights. It was a very profound moment. I knew it was time. I'm going to take a chance and get out of here. I really embraced the unknown. That was the spirit, not knowing what lay ahead. I could feel that my life was going to change. My sister Mary sent me a letter around the time I was struggling. She said, "Hang in there, Molly. I feel you are destined for success. I'm not BSing, really." After I left, I worked at the Melrose Baking Company, which was across the street from the Groundlings, a famous improv school where SNL found a lot of their cast members. This woman I met in an improv class named Pat Cotter took classes at the Groundlings, and she was a really good writer. One day she said to me, "There's this kid who's in Groundlings who you would really click with. Do you mind if I bring him over to Melrose Baking Company?" That was Will Ferrell. I waited on him. I said, "Nice to meet you, Will," and I gave him scones. I kept on auditioning for parts. Auditioning was a piece of the pie, not the main goal, but a part of my overall plan. I wasn't waiting around for auditions, but of course if I got one, I would go. One time, I got called in to meet the producers of a show called Hunter for a very small part, just one line. I had to say, "This is Sergeant Hunter and Sergeant McCall. They are police officers." Eugene warned me that one-line auditions were the worst, and he was right. I had to sell that one little line to 4 producers and 1 casting director, and I still didn't get the job. Another time, I drove Eugene to a callback for Chevrolet. He'd already had an audition and they wanted to see him again. They'd instructed him to dress up like an Orthodox Jewish rabbi, side curls, yarmulke, robes. At the audition, I was checking out all the other rabbis and whispering to Gene, "It's yours." When the audition was over, I was so convinced he was going to get it, we went out and celebrated over iced teas at a 50-style diner. And he got it! He got the part! He was so excited. Chevrolet had to file what's called a Taft-Hartley report since Eugene wasn't in SAG-AFTRA, meaning the producers had to explain their reason for hiring him instead of a union member and send the union his headshot and resume. We were clueless but learning so much about how the biz worked. I still didn't have a commercial agent, but I had meetings with William Morris and Abrams, Rubloff, and Lawrence, 2 biggies. Rejection, rejection. I was heartbroken for about 15 minutes. My dad was actually more upset than I was. I told him they didn't sign me because I'm not blonde and beautiful, and he gave me a talking to. "Well, Molly, if that's what you want to think, you'll never get a commercial agent. That's the easy way out." He was a tough cookie. I fought him for a while until I realized he was right. I was so excited when I got to audition for Seinfeld, a big deal. I knew that if they liked you, they'd cast you in the part that same day. They called in very talented women for that show, and because it was so popular, they got the best comedy performers in town to come in and read. All the other actresses in the waiting room could tell who was staying and who was not asked to stay after an audition, Because if they were interested, you'd be asked to stick around and then at 5:30 head over to another building on the lot to read for the producers. Otherwise, you would read once and nobody would ask you to stay for a second reading. I didn't get asked to stay. Then I ran into Catherine Lanasa, another actress I knew in the parking lot. She had been auditioning for something else that day. Now she was doing ballet stretches by her car, not a care in the world. I wished I could be breezy and casual with auditions like Catherine and not let all the endless rejection get to me. But I couldn't. She said, "Molly, how are you doing? What's going on?" How was I doing? Ugh. I was sliding down into a dark depression. I had just heard the casting director for Seinfeld say, "Hey, thanks for coming in, Molly." Then I had tried to act cheery in front of all the other actresses waiting to still go in to read as I walked out to this parking lot. I'd said, "Bye, everyone. Bye, you guys. Good luck." My sinking heart. My disappointment. Oh, well. Ugh. I watched Catherine do her ballet pliés. And I thought to myself, "I'm going to go buy half a chicken at Gelson's and go home and close my shades. I really don't know if I can do this anymore. I don't think I have the heart for this. There is just too much rejection. It hurts my heart too much. I've been trying and trying for so long." I decided to take a year off. I stopped doing my show. I didn't hustle. I just pulled back and kind of let go. I was getting rejected a lot. Grasping so hard wasn't working. I was close to giving up. Maybe I didn't have what it took. That's when the call came, of course. Marcy Klein, the daughter of Calvin Klein, was the head of the talent department and also a producer for SNL. She was fierce, sexy, no bullshit, with long blonde hair and so smart. They were looking for new cast members. Marcy had gotten close to my manager, Stephen Levy. She thought he was so funny and loved talking on the phone with him. She called and asked for an audition tape. I wasn't going to submit another tape. It was too easy a way for them to say no to me again. I said she needed to come see my stage show if she was interested. If they wanted to consider me, they were going to have to come see me perform live. This time I was going to do it my way. I was a more mature performer. I was more ready. She agreed. I called my partner, Rob. He was a full-time writer at this point and didn't really want to put up our show again. We hadn't done the show for a year. I begged him, "Please, Rob, please, can you just do this one, please? I'll pay for the band, I'll do everything, just show up, that's all I need you to do." "Sure," he said, always reliable and wonderful. 5 years earlier, there had been a woman with her own casting business who would recommend comedians to Lorne Michaels because she knew him. She kind of declared herself a scout for SNL, though it wasn't official. Unfortunately, this woman didn't seem to be very interested in women, which made sense because it was a time when women weren't represented on the show strongly. I remember thinking, she's missing all the good women. But now, lucky for me, that woman wasn't as involved. Marcy Klein was looking for new talent herself and got in touch directly. I was thrilled. Finally, I thought, maybe I'll have a shot. I could always psychologically analyze a hurdle I needed to get over and figure out the problem. When the other woman was going around LA looking for talent for all those years, I thought, "Ugh, I gotta jump over this lady. I don't think she's gonna help me." Now we basically set up the whole show for Marcy. I had 24 hours notice and that show was fucking solid. We rocked the house, paid $300 for the band, and bam! Marcy later told an interviewer that Stephen Levy, quote, called me constantly. He kind of harassed me, but he was very funny about it. And he begged me to see her in Santa Monica. Picked me up and drove me there. And that's how I found Molly Shannon. Her live show was one of the greatest ever. Marcy found me after the show and she said, "Come out for dinner with me." She took me out to the Ivy. I was over the moon. The restaurant was fancy and fun and pink and white and on the beach. Marcy was wonderful and funny and so down to earth, no nonsense. I brought along Mike Palermo, Debbie's brother. When I'd been feeling like quitting, Mike had told me, "Molly, it's impossible for you to stop because by nature, you are a performer. Being a performer is not the same thing as being an actor. Your calling is more specific and your true nature would never allow you to do anything but perform. Mike has always had the ability to cut right to the truth of anything in a crystal clear way. At dinner, Marcy said, "You're coming to New York to audition for SNL. I couldn't believe it. Yippee! Then the woman who wasn't so interested in women got wind that Marcy was flying me to New York City to audition, and she had advice for me. She warned me, "Whatever you do, don't do that character Mary Catherine Gallagher when you go to audition. If you do, you will never, ever get hired. Lorne will hate that. He will hate that dirty little character. Don't do it. You'll never get the job." I thought, out of my way. But to be safe, I said, okay. Marcy was so nice. She said, "Listen, if you have any questions, if you want any tips, just call me." And in the weeks leading up to my audition, I took advantage and called Marcy at NBC every few days. She was unbelievably gracious and helpful. I asked her, "Would it be okay if I flew my partner Rob Muir in to perform with me?" She said, "Yeah, bring your partner." I asked, "Can we wear wigs?" "Yeah, you can wear a wig." "What should I do? What kind of characters? I don't really do impressions." "Do whatever you want." She liked that I was asking her for help, and she really guided me. SNL wanted to find somebody. They flew me to New York first class and put me up at the Paramount Hotel. It was so exciting. It was also nerve-wracking because there were all these other performers flying out to New York City to audition too. We were all on the same flight. But I just remember thinking, I can't believe that I've come this far. I'm a girl from Cleveland, Ohio, who really struggled and went through hard times. Just the fact that I'm being flown to New York City, being put up at the Paramount Hotel to audition for Saturday Night Live is incredible. It felt like a spiritual experience. I just felt so grateful to have gotten this far. What an honor, I thought. It was a real feather in my cap, as my dad said. They put our group, almost entirely women, on stage at a comedy club called Stand Up New York in front of Lorne, Marcy, producer Jim Downey, and Chris Farley. We each got 5 or 6 minutes, and it was a very tough crowd. All tourists who thought that they were going to see stand-up comedy and instead found themselves wondering, what is this, sketch comedy? Before going on, they had us all penned up in a little narrow hallway to the side of the stage, and it was hysteria. The other performers were saying to me, "You brought wigs? I didn't bring wigs. I didn't know we could bring wigs. You brought your comedy partner? I didn't know we could do that." I tried not to let anyone get to me. I just said I'd called Marcy Klein and she told me I could do all this stuff. A good friend I'd met at drama school at NYU, Andrew Schaefer, came with me to the audition and kept me grounded. When people were lining up and starting to get competitive, he said, "Kid, let's just get out of here until it's your turn." Andrew and Rob Muir and I walked around the block over and over again. Rob told me, "After tonight, your life is going to change." Andrew kept checking in to make sure that I wouldn't miss my slot. I was so nervous. He kept me calm. I'm so thankful to Andrew and Rob. I decided to just enjoy the process, that nothing was going to upset me. I got my turn near the end of the night. I don't know if I was last or second to last. I decided to do 5 characters in the 5 or so minutes allotted. I walked out and immediately saw Chris Farley. This is the coolest, I thought. I was so jazzed. But then as I started my first character, nobody was laughing. Crickets. I thought to myself, oh my God, I'm tanking. Oh no. It was a tough crowd. So I gave myself a quick little pep talk. Just be a good actress. Do your best job. Just commit as an actress. Don't worry if you don't get laughs. Just commit with your heart and do it. I told myself this during the 5 seconds while I was turning around with my back to the audience and putting on a new character's glasses. I kneeled down to put the glasses on, slowly, calmly. Deep breath. "It's okay, Molly. It's okay." Then I turned back and shoop, and it went great. Since I attempt for a famous agent, the one who always sent Eugene out for cheesecake, I decided to do an impression of her using her real name. I probably should not have done that. It was an inside thing. I was so green, I didn't really know better. But halfway through, I looked at Lauren and Marcy, and they were dying laughing. I don't think they could believe it. They knew this agent well and seemed to like my impression. For my 5 minutes, I did the character I had created in my stage show, Sally O'Malley, but as Ann Miller, the famous tap dancer, to show them that I could do celebrity impressions. I also did Lisa Marie Presley. And since Rob Muir and I had played these perky talk show hosts in the Rob and Molly show for years, my character was called Sunny Days. I also did her. But I did not do Mary Catherine Gallagher for my audition, just in case that talent scout was right. After my audition, I felt very peaceful and happy. I felt very good knowing that I did the best job I could do. I went back to LA and so many people I knew were coming up to me and saying, I heard you're going to get Saturday Night Live. I said, well, not as far as I know. But I wondered, could this be true? Months passed. I didn't hear anything. Lauren usually has you come back for a meeting if he's pretty sure he's going to hire you. I got a call asking if I could fly back to New York City to meet Lauren. They picked me up in a big black stretch limousine at my apartment in Hollywood. Oh my God, this is thrilling! On the plane to New York, first class again, I sat next to this young, very intelligent, serious businessman. I'm going to meet Lorne Michaels, I told him. How do you think I should approach the meeting? Do you have any tips? Ask him opinion questions, he told me. Don't ask questions that would get just a one-word answer. Don't talk all about yourself. Ask him what he thinks about stuff. And now that I know Lorne, I realize that was the greatest advice ever. He loves giving his opinions about stuff. The businessman offered me his card when we got off the plane, and I took it and put it in my wallet. And I did what he suggested. People get nervous being in front of Lorne, and they try really hard to be funny, and it ends up being such a turnoff. I was more serious in my meeting, and I asked his opinion about a lot of stuff. Because of that, we had a great meeting. It was thrilling meeting him. I'd had a dream years before that I met him in a line, standing and waiting outside against a wall. We started talking and got along well. It was a fantastic dream. Near the end of my meeting, Lauren said, I should warn you that a lot of the cast members get upset if they're not in sketches. I promise if I ever get hired, I won't complain if I'm not in anything, I told him. I will just be so grateful. And I meant it. He said, well, you'll see. And I left feeling like he was watching out for me. I was so happy about how well the interview had gone that I went over to my sister's apartment in Tribeca to celebrate. Mary had gotten married and had given birth to a beautiful baby girl, Shannon Catherine, while I'd been in L.A. Mary, her husband Brian, and I all had a glass of Pinot Noir together to toast my good meeting, and then I left to go back to my hotel. And when I got out onto Duane Street, I got mugged, thrown down on the ground by a jacked-up, wired, very tall drug addict who just whipped me off my feet. But I was so excited that I just met Lauren that I didn't even care. He seemed very nervous, eyes darting around to make sure nobody could see him while he was mugging me. Give me your wallet. Give me a wallet, he whispered in my ear. I could feel his tongue. I thought, oh my God, so this is what it's like to be mugged. This is interesting. He seems nervous too. I will be like water. Take whatever you want, I said. Do you want my coat? He said, nah, that's okay. You can keep your coat. It was a little Stockholm Syndrome moment. Pure terror mixed with, oh, he's being thoughtful while he mugs me bonding. Like, oh, he's sweet. He's letting me keep my coat. What a sweetie pie. He's a gentleman after all. And the next morning, I got a call from the businessman I'd been on the plane. He was worried because a homeless guy had found his business card and called him saying he'd found my wallet on the ground. I told him what had happened and that I was okay. I flew back to Los Angeles, still not knowing anything. Then Stephen Levy, who'd worked so hard to get me the audition, showed up and banged on my apartment screen door one night, smelling like In-N-Out burgers and cigarettes. He walked into my studio and said, you got Saturday Night Live.